OWC Radio 2.0, episode number 26, a conversation with Michael Mulhern from the Retro Computing Roundtable podcast. And as I said, it is OWC Radio 26. You know, usually when I start a show, I'll do a solo segment and then I'll bring the guest in on the second half of the show. We're going to switch it up this week. This week, we're going to bring our guest in right at the beginning. His name is Michael Mulhern. Hello, Michael.
Good morning, world.
You are a podcaster.
Yes, I'm one of the co-hosts of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Now, of course, at Otherworld Computing, we love older computers. We've been supporting them, well, pretty much since the company started. And that support hasn't gone away. I think there's a huge... For a long time, retro meant old and nobody wanted it. I think there's a huge resurgence in old computers and old technology that I've seen really kind of started picking up about 3 years ago. Have you noticed that?
Yes, it's been quite a resurgence in the retro computing hobby, I suppose, or collecting. My friends and I, we do our podcasts, and others have basically, since about 2000 onwards, have noticed an increasing trend in collecting, well, in my speciality, the old 8-bit computers, especially the Apple IIs for me. But it's the last 3-4 years has really pretty much been a golden age.
So how did you get started in podcasting? I know that you guys are coming up on your 100th episode. You're, what, maybe 2 months away from episode 100 at this point?
At this point, we've just posted episode 90 last week.
No small accomplishment, really. I mean, a lot of podcasts don't go that long. You see podcasts launch with all the great intentions that they have, and then, you know, after 20 episodes, they kind of fade away. You guys are still going strong.
Well, we've had a small change in lineup over time, but I think the trick is to have a group of enthusiasts and have, you know, 2, 3, or 4 of us on the podcast at one time, and it just gets a great synergy going.
So who kind of is in charge of the show? Who's the one that makes sure everything's recorded, you have all the audio, and you edit it? Is that you?
No, I just do a lot of the talking.
You do the talking.
we all share that one. But Carrington in the past has pretty much done all of our audio work, but Paul's looking after that at the moment. So just to try and share the responsibilities around, make sure that each of us can actually look after what's going on. As I said, it's a group effort, and that way you really need to share everything around, and that way you can keep everyone enthusiastic and really into the podcast.
So with your accent, I'm assuming Southern Texas.
Oh, a little bit further south. So go to the southern end of Texas and keep going, swing across the Pacific, and if you end up at a Lord of the Rings set, you're not quite far enough over, so then head over to Sydney.
So how long have you been podcasting?
Well, I joined the Retro Computing Roundtable back in episode 65, so I've been recording with them coming up to a year now.
What made you want to get into podcasting? Were you a listener of the show before you started, or how did that come about?
Oh, I had been a listener since I found it, and then downloaded the back catalog. So I've listened to it from episode one, and now joined in the recording. And I've been in listening to quite a few other podcasts. So I have a longish commute to work. And on one of the episodes, Carrington made a bit of an off-the-cuff statement if there was anyone who was interested in joining them on a podcast. So I thought this sounded interesting. Sent off an email. I was just expecting to just guest on a spot or two, but they offered me a rotating position on the roundtable.
That's kind of fun. Is it kind of weird that you listen to something and then all of a sudden you become part of it?
It's very strange. You go from basically being a voyeur, just a member of the audience, and then suddenly you're up there on the stage. And I must say, I had a bit of stage fright on my first recording.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is a bit strange when you consider you're sitting in a room all by yourself and you're getting a little bit butterflies in the stomach, so to speak.
Yeah, but you know what comes after it's recorded. You know that people literally across the entire planet is going to be listening to it, just like you were.
Yes, it does sort of dawn on you, and that's basically how it happened on the first episode, and I don't think it scared me off, and they haven't been able to get rid of me since.
No matter how hard they tried, right?
Oh, they try.
Now, towards the end of our conversation, and I do this with all guests now, we have what's called the three random questions. So I need you to mentally prepare yourself for questions you have no idea what they're going to be. It's just a way for the listeners to get to know you a little bit better.
Sounds like fun.
So what made you get into retro computing? I mean, it's not an expensive hobby, number one. You could buy some really nice older computers for relatively little money nowadays, although they are going up in price a little bit, I've noticed. But, you know, you said you've been doing it for quite a while. What made you get into retro computing? What was the draw to you?
Well, I still had my Apple IIc that I bought back in 1984, and I had been moving house, so I had to pack up everything and then unpack in the new place. And I just got a new interest in using the 2C, and then started thinking about what other older machines were around, and just originally picked up a 512K Mac and a few other earlier machines, some Australian built machines. And it just sort of snuck up on me.
How many do you have?
Not too many compared to others. So I'd have maybe, if we sort of take it back to nothing older than 1990, I've probably got about a dozen machines.
So. Oh, that's not too bad. Your wife's not going to pull her hair out yet.
No, as long as they all gradually move downstairs here to the 8-bit bunker, and it's a case of out of sight, out of mind.
There you go. Well, how much is the most you've ever spent for one of the vintage computers?
Most I've spent would have been recently to pick up a Dick Smith VZ300, a little Z80 machine, but I picked it up with a lot of peripherals and tapes for it. And I think I spent about $150 plus a little bit of shipping. So
that's not bad.
On the current conversion rate, that's pretty much just about $125 US.
That's not bad at all. I mean, and it's a complete computer. You've got a lot of the peripherals. I assume that when you buy a retro computer, they probably come with a lot of disks, most of them, I would hope, because where else are you going to get the programs now?
Well, you can actually download a lot of the disk images.
How do you move from a modern computer to an old computer? I think people listening might be interested in finding out. How do you get that stuff downloaded onto something and then over to the old computer?
Okay, well, we use my Apple IIc as an example because it's a pretty easy one. There's a great piece of software called ADT Pro. And that connects up through your USB or serial port, depending on the age of your main machine, and then connects down to the serial port of the 2C. And then there's a host and server software, and you boot up the 2C, boot up the ADT Pro software, and then it runs in memory, and you can then select a disk image on your PC or Mac, and it will transmit down the USB cable to the 2C and write to disk.
Wow.
So 140K disk image on my Mac, and then you've got a 140K 5.25-inch floppy disk at the other end.
That's pretty awesome. And it's amazing how small those programs are, right?
Oh, and you used to think, oh, so much that you can get on the disks. But one other thing with ADT Pro, it actually is great for people who pick up an Apple II computer and don't have any disks or operating systems at all. It gives you a bootstrap option, so you can hook it up and then just force download a DOS image onto the machine, and you're off.
Huh, that's pretty cool. So what kind of community is out there now? I mean, a lot of the people that are starting to get into retro computing, they weren't around, or at least old enough to have experienced it when they were new, unlike you and I. You know, they're not going to have a clue number one on what they're doing. What kind of community is out there to help the new people getting into retro computing?
Well, apart from the podcasts, there's lots of user groups, Facebook. There's a large Apple II enthusiasts Facebook group. And that's pretty much, I think we've got over 2,000 members of that at the moment. And it just seems to sort of like just steadily grow. But it never ceases to amaze me that there are people who are younger than the years I've spent with computers in total who catch the bug. But I suppose it's the same as young people. Oh, I like using that term, young people.
Makes us old guys feel better.
they get interested in classic cars or
vintage video
early
games
motorcycles or in video games. It's, you know, I suppose, you know, why does someone start collecting stamps or beer coasters? It's something just, I'd like to say, something snaps inside their brain, and then they're off.
I had a lot of vintage computers myself. I lost a few of them. I do have an original, actually I have two, original 128K Max. You know, I don't know, there's something about them. I do turn them on occasionally, although they're put away right now. But the last time I turned them on, they work great. And it seems like, and a lot of people say, man, these old computers, they're just workhorses. They just work. Do you find that they're a little bit more reliable than the new stuff?
While they're still working, they're reliable.
Yeah, there you go.
They're a lot a simpler interface. There's not that screen space to spare on the user interface. There's not that much memory that can be, I suppose, used frivolously on eye candy. They've got to concentrate on the usability, the functionality of the interface, and as you said, they're a workhorse. When I was using my 2C I used AppleWorks on it extensively, creating a database of my library, doing spreadsheeting, word processing. It just opened up the whole screen, and you just got in there and used it. It just seems to be a different way of using the computer than what we do today. You know, at work, I have, you know, two large screen monitors and windows open all over the place, and I still can't find enough screen acreage to do what I want to do. But
what we do with a computer nowadays, with a modern computer, is vastly different than what we were doing back in the 80s and early 90s.
Yes. Also very distracting as well, but
yeah, it's not just I'm going to run this spreadsheet or even Photoshop on some of the not quite older computers, but you know, with the new one, Facebook, Twitter, jumping online, looking at this, looking at that, there's a whole lot of a time suck aspect to it that you really didn't have with those old computers.
No, sometimes it is quite distracting. You can be engaged in whatever you're doing, and then suddenly, oh, I've got a new email.
Do you have any old computer that you haven't got yet that you'd really like to get your hands on?
Yes. There's an Australian rebadge. I think it's a Laser 300, but it was done as the Dick Smith Cat down here in Australia. That's a 6502 machine. And it came with a optional Apple compatibility cartridge. Uh-huh. We say compatibility cartridge, and they say a ripoff of the ROM.
Yep.
But you know, without that, it's just a nice compact 6502 computer. You put the compatibility cartridge in, and you've got yourself a Apple II Plus.
Yeah, Apple didn't like those cards back in the day.
No,
for good reason.
It basically meant Laser were able to build a computer which was essentially everything but the Apple ROM and get it exported, no problems with getting it into Europe or into the US because it was just a computer.
You gotta wonder and if just, Apple would have done...
You just happened to order over by mail a cartridge that you plugged in.
You gotta wonder if Apple would have kind of embraced that culture and took it further with the Mac, where, you know, in the mid to late 90s, Apple would have been. Would they have been in trouble, or would they have been more like IBM at the time or Microsoft? I don't know. But, you know, I guess you can't look back now and go, well, look at all the mistakes they made, because, well, they're not doing too badly nowadays.
No, well, I think they came pretty close, but they have done a great job at being the Lazarus of the computer industry.
Yeah, they seem like it. What kind of computer do you use on a daily basis?
Well, my own machine's a MacBook Air, 2013 model, I believe.
Nice.
But my day-to-day desktop in the office is just a... I think they just replaced my Dell with a HP. Yeah, I think it's a HP. But, yeah, just running Windows 7.
So your company hasn't gone up to Windows 8.1 yet?
Oh, it took us long enough to get off XP.
Tim, don't talk about it. Windows 8. We just got Windows 7 3 weeks ago.
not quite 3 weeks ago, but the only reason I stopped using XP was because the Dell laptop I had, the screen physically died. I was just minding my own business, doing some programming. I got a blue screen of death came up, and I went to do a power off reset of the machine, and there was this crack noise, and the LCD actually broke.
Wow! Really?
So it almost looked like a an impact point on a window. Part of the LCD display still worked. Oh, no idea, but. No, the way computers are effectively commodities these days, it was a case of, we're not even going to bother trying to replace the screen of that. We'll just get your manager to approve this help desk call, and we'll organize a new desktop for you.
Here's a new one. We're not going to bother to fix it.
Yeah. So, to me, those kind of units are just commodities. I think it's a HP and wouldn't have a clue what the model is. Don't care. I turn it on once a month or so and just keep using it until I find it too sluggish, and then I just do a reboot.
So we were talking before we started recording, you were one of the first people to sell an actual Macintosh back in the day. Now it's just called a Mac, of course, but back then it was a Macintosh in Australia because worked for, what kind of company was it?
The company was called Computers and Peripherals. We were in Brisbane, but the main office was out of Melbourne, and as we all know, 84 the computing landscape changed considerably when the Macintosh came out, and we had to wait a little bit, a couple of months, for a shipment to arrive from the US, and I think it was just half a dozen machines, so some. Two went into the Melbourne shop, and then two went up to the Brisbane shop, and the others basically, I think, just sort of went into managers' positions. But we had it in there, and people were interested, and I found MacPaint and MacWrite were very interesting, being able to sort of see on the screen what you were doing. There were WYSIWYG-style word processors for the Apple II series machine. I hadn't used a GS, and I was aware that they were there for the GS.
Yep.
But just the whole difference, you think that the 9-inch screen that the original Macs had was small, but back then that was a fairly typical monitor size, and it was just so different, the crisp black on white, and I didn't even worry me that was monochrome. It just was a very interesting turn for the computing world.
Oh, your color monitor back in 84, man, that was super expensive. I mean, if Apple would have put a color monitor in there, that thing would have cost $13,000.
Ah, easily. I remember buying a color monitor for my 2C. Been using the little 9-inch green screen monitor that I originally bought with it, but I went and bought a color monitor, and that cost me, I think back then, just for a small one, was $500. And we're talking about a stage would have been 85, 86, so allow for inflation. And people complain about spending a couple of $100 on a 22-inch LCD monitor.
Yeah, that's mind-blowing sometimes, especially if you look at some of the old advertisements that you would see from the 80s for computer gear and how much they were charging, and comparatively how much little you were getting. And you think, man, why? That's crazy amount of money for what you got. But that was the state of the art at the time. That was, you know, that's all there was. What do you think you would do if you had to go back in time? Would you rather take, let's say you had to go back to a couple weeks before you sold your first Mac. You go back in time, but you can only take one piece of technology with you. Would you take a modern computer? Would you take an iPad or an iPhone? And let's assume that you could still connect to the internet somehow through magic. What do you think you would take with you?
Oh, that's a hard one.
I think an iOS device would seem, because look, if you took
between the iPad and the iPhone, I think I'd take an iPad.
Yeah, just because of the screen.
The screen, and just the more usability of the apps that are on it. But That's an interesting one.
It'd have to be an iOS device, because that would seem much more magical to people back in the mid 80s than, I mean, because if you brought a laptop or a desktop, a current one, you could still see the progression. You know, you could see the lineage.
Yeah.
You can't see the lineage at all with an iPhone or an iPad.
Well, they wouldn't even recognize it as a monitor to start with, because it's less than a centimeter thick, as opposed to even my 9-inch green screen for my Apple II was deeper than the screen was wide. So yeah, you'd say a 9-inch screen with 12 inches of monitor sticking out the back.
We did have those little LCD screens back in the day, though. They were in computers and stuff like that, but you know,
not that size, but
think about the televisions at the time. Even the best television isn't going to get the resolution as you're going to get on an iPad. It would be crazy. I think about those things. I always think, I should write a book, because I think that would be a fun subject. The problem with writing a book like that, though, is when do you set modern times? You can't, it's got to be realistic. So it has to be, okay, they go from 2013 to 1983. So it's a nice even number, and you know what the technologies are at both of those time frames. But I just think it would be fun to write the reactions to people way back in the day. Imagine going to Apple and meeting with Steve Jobs and showing him an iPad in 1983. Imagine you could just blow their mind, Steve Wozniak holding an iPhone, what that would be like in 1983.
He'd want to take the back off it and reduce the number of chips in it.
Probably. Of course, you couldn't see the chips on the iPad or the iPhone. They're so small. But I think if someone actually did write a book, you'd almost have to get a hold of Steve Wozniak just to ask him what his reaction would have been, so you can make it more accurate in the book. I think that would be a fun project to do.
Certainly would be a different one.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very creative.
Yeah, and who else better to ask than Steve Wozniak of what both his reaction and what he thinks Steve Jobs' reaction would have been at the time, and the rest of the Apple team, because he was pretty involved in 83 at Apple still. And what do you think they would have done if you would have walked in with an iPad or an iPhone? Even if it didn't have internet functionality, I mean, you could still blow their minds with video games and drawing stuff on screen, and it would blow them away. Of course, you got to make sure you bring a charger with you.
Yes, they might have the electricity at the other end, but not the the plug to get in there. Anyway, if I bump into the Woz when he's shopping here in Sydney after he moves, I'll ask him that.
Yeah, is it? Have you heard stuff that he's going to move down there?
Well, there's it's been reported that he is getting Australian permanent residency.
But, he's been down there a lot. I know that
he has. Yeah, yes. He's got family down here. Yeah, it'd be interesting to sort of bump into him. But I'd have to get over the being starstruck to start with. But
well, that was going to be my next question. If you do bump into Steve Wozniak down there, what would you want to ask him about? Oh, look, I stumped you again, didn't I? And I haven't even got to the three random questions yet, man. Come on, Michael.
Well, the first thing I'd do is I'd ask him if he'd be interested in coming to our Apple II Oz K-Fest in March next year as a guest speaker.
He'll probably do that.
But, yeah, I'd be more interested in how he felt about the change coming to Australia. Sort of, does he sort of feel that there's a cultural difference, and like how does he compare it to where he's been in the US and other places of the world? Because if you follow his Twitter feed, he pops up in all of the strangest places.
He really does. I saw that he was in Germany just right before Christmas too.
Oh, you blink and he's on the other side of the planet.
Yeah. So, you were talking about the cultural differences. Do you think that the cultural differences and, look, back in the 80s, it was a lot of differences, but because of the internet, because of this instant communication that we have, for instance, you're doing a show that's heard globally. You hear from listeners globally. That's how you and I met. You sent an email in saying that you were listening to OWC Radio. We probably would never have met otherwise. So we're on a global level. We're sharing our thoughts and ideas that, you know, we glean through the societies that we live in. And when you hear different ideas, that it does influence us. So do you think that the societies of Australia and the United States are all that different anymore?
They're closer than what they have been. There's been a change in the cultural imperialism. I suppose in the early to mid 20th century, Australia pretty much followed the lead of England.
Mm-hmm.
But I suppose from about the 50s onwards, it started to be more influenced by the US culture. And it's now an interesting blend. I think there are quite a lot of similarities, and there's also quite a lot of just little quirky differences between the two. And
you get that in the United States alone.
Oh, yeah. No end of good-natured ribbing between us co-hosts on the round table as well, but because we've got. East Coast, West Coast, covered. We've got Carrington up in Canada and then myself down here in Australia. So, that's a pretty diverse range of guys. But we're all, as you said, drawn together by a common interest, and which would never have happened without the pervasiveness of the internet.
And your show is a good one in that people are going to learn about some of the computing gear that you guys had in Australia that they didn't have other places. Even if it was just a rebadge, I mean, it's the stories behind where that company came from and how they got into making computers. And it's a very rich history that shows like yours really takes a lot of time to explore.
Yeah, that's, I think one of the strengths. Unlike a lot of other shows, which seem to concentrate on a single manufacturer or a single model of the computer, like you've got Commodore podcasts and you've got Apple II podcasts and Atari, and there's got to be more than one podcast for every type of computer that's out there. But RCR made the conscious decision to be the Everyman's podcast. So we were more interested in, obviously, the 8-bit era. So we've just finished show 90. And throughout the episodes of the 80s, we were doing the year of the episode. So mm-hmm. we started doing 1980 through to 1989. And by the time we got to the end of the 80s, it pretty much that was the, I suppose, the to us, the sort of like the fuzzy grey cutoff area between what we considered the retro classic computers and modern. But, you know,
yeah, 1991, that's when the 16-bits really started making a push.
Yeah, but it's still quite a while ago, but it's still, you think there's a computer from the early 90s. It runs a flavor of Windows. Windows was, Microsoft was pretty, had begun its rise to ascendancy then. And you step back to the other side into the 80s and you've got such a diverse collection of machines, operating systems, architectures. It was really almost like cottage industry meets the Industrial Revolution once you stepped across into the 90s.
Yeah, it really was IBM that kind of ushered in mainstream computing. As much as a lot of people would like to think that that was Apple, it really was IBM. Because at the time, businesses, you know, there was an old saying, no one gets fired for buying IBM, which meant if you bought from IBM, you know it's going to be a solid product. They're going to have great customer service and a warranty behind it. And everybody else was kind of an upstart. You didn't know if it was going to be a company that's going to stick around or not, because a lot of computing companies back then didn't stick around. I mean, they, you know, they popped up, they sold, and they were gone.
Yeah, and they only survived, those that did survive only survived by making the IBM compatible.
There's a new show that came out here last fall. It's only like 10 episodes or something. I'm trying to remember the name of it now. And it was about that era of computing. And I'm just drawing a blank. It takes place in the 80s. I think it was on FX. Oh, what is the name of... now I'm going to have to look up on the internet. And I was just...
Halt and Catch Fire.
Yeah. Did you watch that?
Hasn't come to the free-to-air channels down here, or I don't believe it's been on the cable either, but mysteriously it has appeared on computer screens.
I was just going to say, yeah, like that stops anybody who really wants to watch anything nowadays.
Yeah. It's got to the stage now that I'm going to have to set up a, I suppose, a proxy server account somewhere so that I can... see more of the US television websites and video on demand.
Yeah, I think it's crazy that, you know, we exchange information freely nowadays, and yet these restrictions on content is still so strict and in place. I get it in some respects, like the BBC, it's taxpayer, and why do they want to let somebody on the other side of the planet watch something that their taxpayers are paying for? But at the same token, if we really want to watch something, we can get it illegally. So why not take advantage of the legal ways to let someone watch it? It makes no sense to me.
Yeah, it's you know, it really bugs me because you're on there and you really just want to go, look, I want to give you money.
Yes,
I want to give you money for your content. I want to watch it. I want to pay you. Sorry, but your IP address is not in the U.S.
Right. Oh. So here's $2 for let me to watch the next episode of Halt and Catch Fire. There's just no legal way that they'll take your money, and it makes no sense to me. And then they complain about piracy. It's like, well, you're giving people no other recourse. If they really want to watch something, and it's one click to download it, or they can... another click to give you $2, why not take the $2? Why not get over these legal hurdles and do what's right for the industry and for the people who want to watch your content?
No, it's mind-blowing. Mind-blowing stupidity, in my opinion. But
so what do you think of that show? I personally loved it.
I've only seen the pilot in the first episode, mm-hmm. and I thought it was great. It was, as you said, it was really a good character drama set in the 80s.
It really did really, feel like the 80s, too.
Yeah, it really did have an appeal to the retro computing community. But, yeah, I thought it was just a very good selection of a period in history that they could have a character drama. Anything like that. No, they pick the right characters, right. The right storylines, and everyone's captivated.
I was amazed that they did this show. I mean, number one, it's like right in my wheelhouse. It's like they took apart my DNA and say, okay, this is what we want to make a show about. He'll really like this one. But I'm so amazed that they did a show, ostensibly the 80s, a computing company that wants to take on IBM and make an IBM clone. Holy moly. And then the year that they set it, it's a fictional company, so you wonder how much they're going to mess with history, because it is a TV show. But then you start thinking, yeah, but while they're doing all this, you know that Apple's about to release the Macintosh, and what that's going to do to the entire computing industry, not right away, but eventually. And where is that going to leave this fictional little company that wants to, this in Texas, that wants to make an IBM clone? How does that change everything? And what would they think about, what would these characters think about that computer? You know, I keep thinking of things like that as I'm watching that show, and where the industry is going, because you and I were there at the time. We remember what it was like. So, yeah, I was just curious. You got to watch the rest of them, man.
Oh, I'll add that to my to-watch list.
You know, on the Retro Computing Roundtable podcast, you guys linked to an IBM PS2 commercial from the MASH cast, which I completely forgot about until I saw it on there and watched it. And I thought, I haven't seen this commercial in 30 years.
Sometimes it's a bit of a surprise. As I said, we have a rotating host for the show, and sometimes the host will actually put in the link to the YouTube video that we're going to put in there. And other times, especially this time of year, you're flat out doing other things. And I always fast forward through, well, not fast forward, I listen to our show on about 1.5-2 times speed just to continually check it, and then that ad came up, and I had to basically wait till I got to work, because you can't play with your phone while you're driving, and went back and listened to it again as I was making my coffee, and then went and found it and watched it, and it's one which I hadn't even been aware of. So it was a nice surprise.
It was. It took me back, I could tell you that, because I remember when that commercial was on. It aired quite a bit because it was a cast of a very popular TV show, you know, hawking IBM PCs. I thought that was pretty cool. Of course, back then, I really wasn't into computers at all. I didn't get into computers until 94. But, you know, it was still, I remember those commercials back in the day. Let's get to the much dreaded, much maligned, not really, three random questions. I think you've got the easiest ones that I've had so far, and these are random. I go to a website and I just basically do a quick search and I pick the ones that come up. And I think you're getting off light this time compared to a couple other guests. But you ready for the three random questions?
No, but proceed.
Number one, this is the easiest one. What's your favorite movie? I said this was an easy one.
Well, you said your favorite, so I'm having to whittle it down. So I would have to say the Star Wars.
The original one or the trilogy altogether?
No, no.
1977.
The first one. It's 77, episode 4.
What was it? Yeah, what was it called episode 4 when it first came out, you know? It was just called Star Wars.
A New Hope or something. Yeah. So, yeah, I just, when we went in there, you know, so it was high school, and just the opening scenes, it just was so unlike any other movie I'd ever seen. It was just phenomenal.
Just blew you away.
Star Wars. It did, literally.
Yep. Number two.
I've been a Darth Vader fan ever since.
Well, who hasn't? I think he's probably the most popular bad guy of all time.
Of all times.
Number two, where did you go on your first airplane ride?
Mackay.
Oh, cool. That's a good place to go.
Yeah, as young boys, my brothers and I would be put on a plane by our parents in Brisbane, and we would fly to Mackay, where my godparents lived, and we would spend a week or two with them, travel up into the hinterland to the beach, and it's just some of the best childhood memories that I've got. And
during school break.
School breaks, yeah. Yeah, it was just a unbelievable time of childhood.
So were you the oldest or the youngest or in the middle?
I'm the oldest.
You're the oldest.
All my fault.
I think the oldest has it the hardest, because as the oldest child, your parents are learning how to be parents with the oldest child. They're going to make a lot of mistakes. They're going to set boundaries and realize they probably need to be adjusted.
My brothers had it so easy. But Michael did this, but Michael did that.
Yeah.
Why can't I do this?
Yeah, that's always the case. At least as a parent myself, my oldest is 21. My youngest is 7. So there's quite a bit of difference there. And I think, at least I'd like to think, that I'm a much better parent now than I was when my oldest was born. Because you get so much more experience.
Or more blasé.
So it was all boys, huh?
All boys, yeah. Mm. Three brothers.
Oh, so there's four of you all together.
Mm. Yep.
What's the age differences?
13 years between myself and my youngest brother.
Wow, that's almost a generation, really. I mean, because by the time he's ready to play with toys, you're at university.
That was pretty much it.
Yeah. So growing up, was computers big in your family?
No. I suppose I had a little bit of early exposure to programmable logic circuits that went into controllers and things. I remember being sweatshop labor for my father, sitting there cutting wires and tinning them and building controller units for various things.
So your dad was into electronics?
Yeah, he started off as an electrician, then moved into sales. So, So we've had the background. So I sort of moved more into programming. Patrick's more of your hardware kind of guy. And then Terry's in, he's a professor down at Melbourne University. And then my youngest brother, he's the black sheep of the family. He went into sales like Dad.
Oh, that's cool. Must be fun in the holidays.
Yeah, we don't get together that often. We're spread pretty much along the east coast of Australia. So there's about 1,000 kilometres between each of us. And we've never got along so well being spread out along the coast.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
when's the last time you got together with everybody?
Oh, last time when it's everybody.
Everybody,
back,
sure.
Yeah, back in the mid-90s.
Oh, you got to get together with them all. You got to plan some kind of a big family event. Got to do it.
Had almost everybody together for my father's 70th.
Is your dad still with us?
Oh, yes. I can't get rid of him. Yeah, he's all, I'm his tech support. So he's up on the Sunshine Coast in Queensland. So that's about 1,000 kilometres north of Sydney. I use remote access to show him how to do things on his laptop, diagnose problems. But no, he took to computers pretty well.
I was going to say, I mean, he was, from his background, how could he not? I mean, this is kind of a nat. And he was there through all of it, from when there was absolutely no computers to now.
Mm.
What's his favorite? Is he a Mac guy, a PC guy, a tablet?
No. My father's favorite computer is the one that he can log on to the golf club and make his course book in. A practical man.
Uh-huh. That's cool. Last question. Your three favorite Mac or PC applications. I told you, you got it very easy this time. I had a shower question before. So you got off pretty easy here.
Okay. Mac or PC.
Yep. So you got to take a Mac or a PC with you somewhere. You can only have three applications on it, and we discount browsing the internet or email. So those are just going to be there no matter what. So you only get three more applications. What are they?
Well, let's see. I'll be taking my Mac, so all the iLife suites there.
Not easy?
Okay. Not easy at all, because I'm just trying to think of what... So do I have internet access?
Yes. Yes, okay, but the only applications that are on it is Safari and Mail. So you don't get... iTunes isn't on there. It's not a standard computer. It's those we give you those applications so you can get email, you can browse the internet. Everything else is nothing. So you have to pick three things to put on there.
Well, I'll put Skype on.
Okay, so you could talk to people.
You've got a web browser, so I can basically use any online HTML5 application.
Sure.
So that's plenty of things there. I'd actually take my Apple II emulator. Along with I don't have to take the disk images because I've got the net to get hold of those. So that's two. Civ 2.
Oh, really?
The Windows 3.1.1 version. Run that under DOSBox.
Oh, that's awesome.
Run it under Boxer.
I was kind of expecting iTunes or something. So you have all the music and all the movies and all the TV shows.
Oh, you didn't tell me I didn't have my phone in my back pocket, so that's got all my music. I could stream it.
That's so. Nowadays, absolutely. If you got a web browser, then you got Netflix, right? Or
I'm sorry, but your deserted tropical island is not in the U.S.
Michael, I want to thank you very much for being on this episode of OWC Radio. If people want to follow you, they want to listen to the podcast, they want to go to your blog, where should they go?
Well, there's the RCR podcast.com. I'm sure you can put a link to that in your notes. If anyone's interested in my occasional ramblings, there's my blog. So we'll put a link to that, but that's at jongleur.co.uk/blogs.
And I've got a link to that. So people don't want to write on the dust on their dashboard. They just go to blog.macsales.com and you'll find it for episode 26. You'll find the show notes and the links will be there. What about Twitter? Are you on Twitter?
I am on Twitter. Just trying to remember my handle.
you're not a big Twitter guy?
No, more of just a follower than a leader. Use it to keep in contact with people.
Any other websites that you want to mention?
No, I think that pretty much covers it.
Cool. Michael Mulhern. Did I say that right? Mulhern. Felt like I said it wrong. I don't know why.
It's the accent. I've heard it said worse, but that was pretty good.
Now, you say accent. Obviously, I have it a U.S. accent, but does it sound different than most U.S. accents?
Yes. Talk to quite a few people in the US, but I haven't found anyone over there which I can't understand, and most seem to be able to understand me, but no problems at all.
Awesome. Thanks very much for being on this episode of OWC Radio, man.
Great to talk to you, Tim.
And I'm back here, OWC Radio. I hope you guys enjoyed that conversation. I did. I thought that was great. Thank you very much, Michael, for being on this episode of OWC Radio. As I record this, I'm actually getting my suitcase ready and some of my gear and gearing up for OWC at CES. Of course, CES starts, as I record this, in less than a week. And I hope that some of you might be there. And if you are, make sure you stop by our booth. We are in the South Hall, the third floor, booth space 30572. And we will have special guests. And when I'm at the show, I'm actually going to do some recording for OWC Radio. So if you can't make it to CES, tune in next week and get a little bit of the flavor of CES here on OWC Radio. I'm going to bring my truly portable recording equipment, which is plugging a microphone directly into my iPhone and recording that way, which reminds me, I got to delete some stuff off my iPhone. You know, I just realized I haven't tried my portable recording stuff on the new 6 Plus, so I guess maybe I ought to do that before I head out. Otherwise, I have to steal my wife's 5S and use that one. Ugh, what a horror, huh? No, the 5S is a great phone. And I'm sure my recording gear will work just fine on the 6 Plus. I just haven't tested it yet. But so obviously some of the recordings, the audio quality will be quite different than what I'm used to recording and what you're used to hearing here on OWC Radio. But I'm looking forward to it. It's one of those shows that there's so much to see and so much to do that I personally won't be able to see most of it. But I look forward to seeing what I can see and having some of the people from the show right here on OWC Radio. I don't even know who is going to be on the show yet. So, again, next week, CES, OWC will be there. And I hope to see you there. And if not, I hope you tune in next week and listen to whatever it is that I record there. You know, I do love feedback from you guys. I really, really do. And Joseph H. sent in some feedback, and I'm going to attempt to read it because I can't find my reading glasses. I'm not quite sure. I think I left them in the car, and my wife has the car right now where my reading glasses may be. I've got a couple pair, but I simply can't find them. So I'm going to squint a little bit and try to read this, and, you know, it happens. So Joseph H. writes, and remember I was talking about printers on the last show, and I was talking about your favorite or sequels to movies. That was one of the three random questions last week. And so Joseph H. writes in, so printers, yes, indeed. So in other words, I was asking, do you guys still use printers? And this is Joseph's answer. Anytime I need to return an online purchase, I like to use online postage because you typically get tracking included. And some sites do free returns, but you have to print a label. That's absolutely true. I didn't even think about that aspect of it. But the flip side of that is I can't remember the last time I've had to send something back. A lot of sites nowadays, like Amazon, for instance, I had a Kindle go bad. And I call them up. I talk to someone and, yep, we'll send you out your new replacement Kindle right away. I think it showed up the next day. And I thought I was going to have to ship my old one back. But no, they just said, keep it. It didn't work anymore, but the point was I was surprised that I didn't have to send it back. It seems like there would be, you know, the possibility of some abuse there, but I guess if you're a huge corporation like Amazon, to ship it back probably costs more than what they're going to get in return for that old Kindle. And they do track usage of Kindle, so I think if someone started using your old Kindle all the time, they would know something's up and maybe put up a red flag. I don't know. But that's a great point, Joseph. Return postage for online purchases. Continuing with his email, aside from that, photos. I still maintain, and a number of others do, that holding an 8x10 or any print in your hand has a different emotion and connotation than handing someone your iPhone or your iPad and saying, look at these 100 photos I snapped. Perhaps in one of the differences in a snapshot and a photograph. So I kind of get that. If you look at an actual picture, someone hands you a 5 or 6 pictures to look through, is there a more of an emotional connection with those photos than looking at photos on someone's iPhone? I think there is. Now, I don't know if that's an age thing, a generational thing, or it's this is an actual picture I'm holding. We print pictures here at home. Usually it's pictures that mean a lot to us and that we want to put on a wall. We had a family photo taken, me, my wife, and our kids all together, and we were dressed real nice. It was for a wedding. And someone took the photo on my iPhone. And when I got home, I looked at that photo, and I thought it was a great photo. I printed it out on the semi-gloss photo paper large size, printed it, put it in a frame, put it on the wall. I printed a smaller one, and it's in my office at OWC. So, yeah, I think there is a, you know, when you would take photos with film cameras, you were very selective on what you would take a picture of, because to get them developed wasn't cheap, and you didn't want just a whole bunch of pictures of nothing, and that cost you money. But with a camera on every iPhone and iPad and Android devices and window phones and digital cameras, people take pictures of everything because there's really no cost associated with developing that photo. But that doesn't mean you print all of those photos, does it? I bet for the number of photos that most of us print compared to the photos in our iPhoto library, there's a huge discrepancy, right? You print the great ones, the ones you have an emotional connection to, or the ones that look great, or that has meaning. You don't print everything. So I agree with you, Joseph. I think that holding a photo in your hand carries more of an emotional weight than just handing someone your iPhone and saying, here's our trip to Paris. Take a look at these photos. Continuing with his email. And I got my mom a Canon selfie 4x6 printer because she wanted a quick, simple solution for printing without my dad cranking up the iMac and spending hours. She likes carrying a few of the kids and grandkids in her purse, and this is way faster for her. Yes, she could go stand at CVS, Walmart, but those self-service kiosks are frequently down, she says. And I think Joseph was also the one that sent me an email of the kiosks. I think it was at CVS. There's a piece of paper taped to the printing kiosk, and it says out of paper. I thought that was funny. I also talked about parental controls and what do you do there. And he writes, parental controls, not yet, but the 6-year-old is closely monitored and the 20-month-old, while knows the YouTube app on iOS, isn't there yet. And he does use controls on TiVo. You know, it's been about 3 weeks now since I took off the parental controls off my daughter's laptop. One of the things I've noticed is her laptop use has gone up. She's using it more often. And I have gone in and looked at her history. Not right in front of her. I kind of waited till she's in bed and asleep, and then I'll pull out her laptop and kind of take a look through. She's been very responsible, I have to say. She's not going to anything that she shouldn't. And she still does come to me when it comes to going to brand new websites. Almost a little paranoid about what she should and should not be looking at. But I think it's a healthy paranoia, and I want her to be like that. My son, on the other hand, a few video games that he plays, he can get in-game coins if he watches an ad, and the ads are all video. And he is constantly running up when he's playing these games, handing me the iPhone or the iPad, saying, can I watch this video? And if he watches the video, he gets some coins in the game, and that allows him to buy armor for his little character and, I don't know, stuff like that. And I have taken a look at those, and it's always ads for other games. And I've yet to see any explicit content that I wouldn't want a 7-year-old to look at. So I'm still confident with our ability to monitor her, and he is, I think he's picking up cues from her. I want to make sure I can look at this, and I have to ask mom and dad for that. So I'm still on the fence with parental controls. I'm monitoring the situation, but I'd still like to hear what you have to say. Or maybe you've got a story that the parental controls didn't work. Your kids did get to something that they probably should not have. So please, if you've got any questions or comments or advice on parental controls on your electronic devices, let me know. I'll share it right here on OWC Radio with all of us other parents out here who are constantly looking for advice. And finally, we get back to his email. And finally, yes, the sequel. I don't have one from this morning's commute. He still doesn't have one from the morning commute. But I can't imagine Breakfast Club, Bender in 30 years. Either a normal guy, a normal dad, or in jail. Of course, my pick, and this was referring to what movie deserves a sequel that never had one, I said The Breakfast Club. I still think that would be my choice. I've had a couple weeks to think about it. I still would love to see a Breakfast Club sequel. I saw Charlie Sheen, who wasn't on the Breakfast Club, by the way. He had that very small role in Ferris Bueller's Day Off. He is reprising that role in a television show called The Goldbergs. And if you remember Ferris Bueller's Day Off, he was the guy sitting in the police station with a leather jacket, kind of a bad boy, and he talks to one of the main characters. He's doing the same thing for the show The Goldbergs, which is actually a show set in the 80s that my wife and I really like. And I just thought that was funny. I don't know why. It just popped into my head, so I thought I would share. Thank you very much, Joseph, for sending in your email. I really, really do appreciate it. It makes my job a whole lot easier knowing what you guys are thinking out there. And if you have any questions, I would love to answer them right here on the show. If it's a question that I don't know, there's a lot of people at OWC, a lot smarter than I am, who can answer it. So if you've got a Mac question, let me know. Send an email in. You're having a problem with a Mac and you just can't figure it out, send an email in. We'll figure out the answer together and we'll share it with the world. In the meantime, make sure you go to MacSales.com. We've got a lot of sales going on right now at the end of the year. So before January 1st, make sure you go to MacSales.com. And if you're not already, follow us on Facebook and Twitter. We're constantly putting up really great sale pricings on merchandise right now. But again, most of this stuff is on sale for ridiculously low prices until the beginning of the year. It's the Area 51, the special clearance prices. Come get it now because, again, these prices are going away. If you already missed the holiday pricing that we had, there was some really great stuff on there. I hope some of you guys and gals took advantage of the amazing prices that I was seeing. I bought a few things myself. My daughter, my second oldest daughter, wanted a smart cover for her iPad mini. I went to Best Buy. They were $55. I couldn't believe it. I think the cheapest I found them was $49. I bought one at OWC, $29. Same smart cover from Apple, $29 at OWC. I can't guarantee how long those prices would be good, but you got to go to the site. You got to check it out. Need headphones for you that came with your iPad, or I'm sorry, your iPod Touch, the ones without the mic. We had those for less than $5 during the holiday sale. Less than $5. Less than $20 for the one that came with the iPhone that fits right inside your ear with the microphone. Less than $20. So, but you got to go to MacSales.com and take a look. Follow us on Twitter. Follow us on Facebook. Get early announcements that way of when things go on sale and be the first in line, because like everything else, there's a limited supply of what we're selling. And once it's gone, you miss the sale. You miss that great price. You're not going to get it. So follow us on Twitter, follow us on Facebook. That way you can be right at the top of the line of getting these amazing deals. It was an iMac, and it was less than $120. We had one left. I posted it up on Twitter. Before I even had a chance to go post it up on Facebook, boom, gone. Just like that. So if you're not following us on Twitter and you're not following us on Facebook, you're going to miss out on some amazing deals. So once again, my name is Tim Robertson. I would love to have feedback from you. The email address is owcradio@macsales.com. You can find show notes for this and any other show at blog.macsales.com. So if you're listening to an older episode and we talk about a certain website and you cannot find it, go to blog.macsales.com and go to our show notes. If you scroll down to the bottom of the page, there's a permanent banner that says on another episode of OWC Radio. Now, the banner always has the most recent, but if you click that banner, it actually brings up all the past episodes of OWC Radio, going all the way back to the very first episode. So if you're listening to an archived episode and you want to find the show notes, that's where you go, blog.macsales.com. So I tell you what, I got to go. I've got so much I need to get done before I jump on a plane this Saturday and fly out to Las Vegas for CES to work at the OWC booth. I will be back in time next week. I'm not there the entire show. So I will be back in time next week to actually put a show together and release it, hopefully by the end of next week. And I look forward to enjoying CES, and I really look forward to finding out who I can interview and what kind of show we can put together. please send feedback, owwcradio@maxsales.com, and I'll see you next week.